Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 866. Because They Can, part two, more about technocratic fascism. This is being recorded on October 4th of the year 2015. We're going to be once again, keynoting a program with a consummately important excerpt from a very important, very insightful article that I have excerpted a number of times and will be doing so again. As many veteran listeners will no doubt guess, that comes from an article by David Golumbia, G-O-L-U-M-B-I-A, and he wrote this in uncomputing.org from April 23rd of this year being 2015. The article is titled Tor Technocracy and Democracy, and it is referring at a superficial level to the development of the Tor secret or encrypted communications network. However, what he is really talking about is what I have termed technocratic fascism. And we're going to be taking a look at technocratic fascism, and I want to stress at the beginning that I think there is nothing more insidious than what is really the latest, and I think in many ways the most potent or certainly marketable, seductive form of fascism, and that is a doctrine that is being subsumed under the title of libertarianism. I should stress that I have known many people who call themselves libertarians and who were attracted to that, who were not only not fascists, but who gravitated to libertarianism because of their inherent or instinctive opposition to overweening totalitarian government. And certainly the title is wonderful, Liberty. Who isn't for liberty? I certainly am. But as I noted in an earlier program, you can only have real freedom. You can only have real liberty when freedom and liberty are married to responsibility. All people make mistakes, and you have to be responsible for your actions. Not only mistakes, if you F the duck, you clean up the tail feathers, but you have to be consciously responsible so that you interact with your fellow human beings in a supportive and viable fashion. People have long sought the rule of law and government because it is only law and government that can protect the average citizen against the abuse of power by those who are more powerful than themselves and who would use that power to act upon them in ways that they would not like. Mussolini, the very first fascist, termed his system the corporate state, and he said, quote, "Il fascismo e il corporatismo." Fascism is corporatism, and what we are going to be looking at is a continuation of our long exploration of the adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook. We're going to be looking at, once again, people calling themselves libertarians. This is in no way, again, to cast aspersions on individual libertarians. Again, I've known many who are attracted to the philosophy because of their anti-totalitarian instincts. However, as that old expression has it, count your buttons before doing them up. And people have to be very, very careful. If I were going to mint a political ideology, it would be called responsibilitarianism. And I think that libertarians need to consider that possibility. We're going to be examining some programs that are new, some articles, I should say, that are new, and some that we have dealt with before, by way of underscoring the essence of technocratic fascism. I'm going to read some quotes from some articles that I am going to go into at greater length. So to begin, the keynote comes from uncomputing.org, April 23rd, 2015, by David Columbia, Tor, Technocracy, and Democracy, and encapsulating and boiling down the article. Such technocratic beliefs are widespread in our world today, especially in the enclaves of digital enthusiasts, whether or not they are part of the giant corporate digital leviathan. Hackers, civic, ethical, white, and black hat alike, hacktivists, WikiLeaks fans, and Julian Assange, anonymous members, and even Edward Snowden himself, walk hand-in-hand with Facebook and Google in telling us that coders don't just have good things to contribute to the political world, but that the political world is theirs to do with what they want, and the rest of us should just stay out of it. The political world is broken, they appear to think, rightly at least in part, and the solution to that, they think, wrongly at least for the most part, is for programmers to take political matters into their own hands. First, Tor co-creator Dingledon claimed that Tor must be supported because it follows directly from a fundamental, quote, right to privacy, unquote. Yet when pressed, and not that hard, he admits that what he means by right to privacy, unquote, is not what any human rights body or, quote, particular legal regime, unquote, has meant by it. Instead of talking about how human rights are protected, he asserts that human rights are natural rights and that these natural rights create natural law that is properly enforced by entities above and outside of democratic polities. Whether UN's Universal Declaration on Human Rights of 1948 is very clear that states and bodies like the UN, to which states belong, are the exclusive guarantors of human rights, whatever the origin of those rights. Dingledon asserts that a small group of software developers can assign to themselves that role, and that members of democratic polities have no choice but to accept them having that role. Further, it is hard not to notice that the appeal for natural rights is today most often associated with the political right, for a variety of reasons. Our neocon Leo Strauss was one of the most prominent 20th century proponents of these views. We aren't supposed to endorse Tor because we endorse the right. It's supposed to be above the left-right distinction, but it isn't. And again, what he's talking about here, repeating part of that phrase, all of these people, and again, I think I'm going to have to do a fireside chat about technocratic fascism and go into this, but he's talking about coders, whether the giant big tech companies, Facebook with 1.5 billion users, or Google, or Yahoo, or any of these companies. They're telling us, quote, coders don't just have good things to contribute to the political world, but that the political world is theirs to do with what they want, and the rest of us should just stay out of it. Skipping down. Members of democratic polities have no choice but to accept them having that role. That doesn't sound very democratic to me. And another article, I will read more of this. This is called Cryptocurrency Taxation May Subvert National Collection by someone calling himself Travis Patron, P-A-T-R-O-N. I don't know if that is a pseudonym or a nom de plume, but I suspect that may be the case. This is from Diginomics of September 6th of 2015. Talking about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency by operating behind a veil of cyber secrecy. it is reasonable to forecast the impracticality of systemic taxation on these types of financial assets from national jurisdictions. Individual enforcement of taxation is likewise impractical due to ideological backlash governments would receive for targeting individuals who avoid national taxation via information technologies. And skipping down. Governments initially attempting to control cryptocurrency taxation through the businesses and bottlenecks which it can be monitored through will meet with as much success as they have limiting file sharing, illegal downloads, and Tor operations. Cryptocurrencies have an inherent regulation, that of law from number. Truly, check this, truly, Bitcoin is code as law. And that basically is coming right out and saying what David Golombia was talking about. And we'll deal with this at greater length there in presently in this program. And last, we're going to be talking about the smart contracts, a new technological development that not only may put lawyers out of work, it's not just fast food workers and others who may be replaced by apps, but lawyers, but even more terrifyingly, these smart contracts can permit a number of anonymous functions to be performed, including the for-hire vandalizing of a given website or the paying of a contract on an assassination contract on a public official. And Gavin Wood is the chief technology officer at Ethereum, and he loves the concept of smart contracts. And however, note the following. Note the implicit ethic in what he says, and we'll talk more about this. However, Wood acknowledges it is likely that Ethereum will be used in ways that break the law, and even says that is part of what makes the technology interesting. Just as file sharing found widespread unauthorized use and forced changes in the entertainment and tech industries, illicit activity enabled by Ethereum could change the world, he says. The potential for Ethereum to alter aspects of society is of significant magnitude, says Wood. This is something that would provide a technical basis for all sorts of social changes, and I find that exciting, skipping down. You can implement any web service without there being a legal entity behind it, he says. The idea of making certain things impossible to legislate against is really interesting. Well, I agree with him that that is really interesting in a very bad and scary way, with the ethic that was, I think, nailed by David Golombia. And again, I think that is a very important article, with the ethic that was enunciated by the article, in the article by Travis Papin, and we'll go into that, and in the ethic that was explicitly articulated by Gavin Wood, the chief technology officer of Ethereum, we are seeing a form of technocratic fascism. Beyond that, at a psychosocial level, this is sociopathy. They basically are saying they are giving the middle finger salute to any notion that they are responsible to a higher authority, and by that I don't mean a religious higher authority, but that they have any overarching responsibility to the society in which they live. Although many of the people, no doubt, working for these companies are altogether moral, as different as this cyber-libertarianism or anarcho-fascism or technocratic fascism appears, it is actually part and parcel to the Republican Party, who will shut down the government rather than implement increased taxes on the wealthy, and with all of the, frankly, juvenile politics in which they engage, really throwing temper tantrums if they don't get their way. And as we will see in the article about cryptocurrency, this represents a form of cyber offshoring. In our conversations with Lucy Commissar, we have gone into offshoring at some length.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
In many discussions with Lucy Commissar, we have talked about offshoring as not necessarily storing funds offshore to prevent the U.S. or other governments of taxing them, but ways of circumventing taxation. I would note that although certainly nobody particularly likes paying taxes, the fact of the matter is they are one side of things most people not only want, but that they take for granted. When you're talking about government, you're talking about delivering the mail. You're talking about processing sewage. You're talking about keeping the drinking water safe. You're talking about monitoring air pollution. As we speak here in California, there are some major wildfires raging. You are assuming that government is going to fight the fire and not let it burn your house down. And maybe you both halves of your very own A blank blank at the same time. The East Coast is getting inundated, even as California is facing a drought. When, for example, a hurricane or a tornado strikes, people are assuming that the government will take care of things. They take disaster relief for granted. But whether it's monitoring food safety or the safety of prescription drugs that people take or whatever, this costs money. And to pay for it, you have to have taxes. And one of the things that is bedeviling us is the corporate state and the way in which major corporations have been able to subvert our regulation. As you listen to the discussion of technocratic fascism or cyber libertarianism or anarcho-fascism, place this against the background of, well, we've got to reduce big government, and if we reduce taxes on the wealthy, well, gee, they'll just plow all that extra capital into creating jobs and making everything wonderful. And little Maxfield Parrish-style cherubim will descend in pastel colors, playing little harps and scattering rose petals around. And we will all live in a blissful society. Yeah. As you listen to this, this is part and parcel to the lunatics. They're not lunatics, actually. They're not crazy at all. The people who see them as benign are either crazy or perhaps stupid. But when I talk about technocratic fascism, place this against the background of the Republican Party and what I termed in For the Record Program 851, post-Reaganoid political dementia. Ronald Reagan intoned that government isn't the solution to your problems. Government is the problem. And whether it's Edward Snowden arrogating to himself 2.7 million secret documents from the NSA and distributing to individuals unknown the operational architecture of the NSA, which, by the way, he could not possibly have gotten by getting people's passwords. When we update The Adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook, we'll talk about the fact that he must have been directed by one or more major intelligence services. He could not have done what he is alleged to have done by himself. Just as Lee Harvey Oswald was no lone nut and didn't kill President Kennedy, Edward Snowden is no lone hero. He isn't a hero at all. He is the obverse Oswald. But again, we're looking at people who are arrogating to themselves tremendous power and doing so without the slightest regard for the possible consequences of their actions upon the people who will be affected by those actions. Not necessarily with the will or foresight of the people who have arrogated to themselves this power. So, against the background of the David Columbia article from uncomputing.org, let us plunge deeper into the, to me anyway, terrifying world of technocratic fascism. Now, turning to discussion of cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin as a form of cyber offshoring along the lines of what we have examined so often in our discussions with Lucy Commissar, I'm going to excerpt an article from Diginomics of September 6th of 2015. This is authored by someone who writes under the name of Travis, T-R-A-V-I-S, Patron, P-A-T-R-O-N, as in Nancy. The article, Cryptocurrency Taxation May Subvert National Collection. And again, note the fundamental subversive perspective here. What this is talking about is anti-state, anti-government. This epitomizes the arrogance of the technocratic, fascistic orientation. Basically, it is a form, it is sociopathy raised to the level of a social ethic and marketed under the most misleading brand name of libertarianism, of cyber offshoring and its fundamentally subversive orientation toward the very nation states that most of us take for granted. Again, purify the water. See to it that the sewage doesn't back up into our sinks at home. To regulate food and pharmaceutical safety and so many other things that people take for granted. Fixing the roads, maintaining bridges, seeing to it that airplanes don't collide in the middle of the air. We read, I'm going to excerpt this article. The entire article is not only linked, but is included in the description for the record, 866. Quote, Travis Patron, unquote, writes, in Cryptocurrency Taxation May Subvert National Collection, as the age of cryptocurrency comes into full force, it will facilitate a subversively viable taxation avoidance strategy for many of the technically savvy users of peer-to-peer cryptographic payment systems. In doing so, cryptocurrency use will act to erode the tax revenue base of national jurisdictions and ultimately reposition taxation as a voluntary pay-for-performance function. In this post, I'd like to cover some of the benefits such a strategy will have for cryptocurrency investors, why our notion of taxation is ripe for disruption, and why cryptocurrency taxation is enabled by default. Although investors have been lured by the siren song of tax haven for as long as governments have existed, none have existed with the legal and structural characteristics such as those found in cryptocurrency. By operating behind a veil of cyber secrecy, it is reasonable to forecast the impracticality of systemic taxation on these types of financial assets from national jurisdictions. Individual enforcement of taxation is likewise impractical due to ideological backlash governments would receive for targeting individuals who avoid national taxation via information technologies. Even so, many jurisdictions have already declared digital currency transactions something which occurs between consenting parties on the network which no one owns to be taxable under current legal frameworks. Skipping down. As we explained in the report, Bitcoin may become a global reserve instrument. Never before has there existed a tool that can preserve economic and informational assets with such a high degree of security combined with a near zero marginal cost to the user. This revolutionary capability of the Bitcoin network does and will continue to provide a subversively lucrative tax superhaven in direct correlation with its acceptance on a worldwide basis. Coming down again. Governments initially attempting to control cryptocurrency taxation through the businesses and bottlenecks which it can be monitored through will meet with as much success as they have limiting file sharing, illegal downloads, and Tor operations. Cryptocurrencies have an inherent regulation, that of the law from number. Truly, Bitcoin is code as law. Now, of course, interrupting, if you don't happen to be a coder, well, there is no law for you, is there? Think about that. Skipping down yet again. In his conclusion, he writes, make no mistake, in a crypto-anarchist jurisdiction where there is no means to confiscate or control property on behalf of another individual, the need for the state will cease to exist. Mass taxation on digital currency is not feasible through judicial enforcement, while individual enforcement is bound to prove ineffective. You or anyone motivated to retain their net worth will find a subversively lucrative tax haven in the realm of cryptocurrency. And we're going to come back to secure cyber communications and financial regulation as we talk about the new end-to-end encrypted symphony messaging system that has been adopted by many of the same financial institutions and not only helped to bring about the collapse of 2008, but that are implicated in the LIBOR rigging scandal. And we'll talk about that in a minute. I would note that among the manifestations of technocratic fascism is the replacement of workers with technology if they, quote, get out of line, unquote. By getting out of line, among other things, asking for too much money, for example, a raise in the minimum wage. And for the record, 851, we took a look at the threat that has been floated to those fast food workers and others earning minimum wage who are trying to get the minimum wage increased, in some cases, to $15 an hour. The threat is basically you will be replaced with an app. Now, of course, maybe in the fireside chat, if a worker is replaced, whether they don't make a lot of money or not, is the app going to continue to buy food? Will they buy food or clothing or pay their rent or whatever? What is going to happen to their creditors? What is going to happen to the people who sell them goods and services? Well, obviously, they are going to be hurt as well. And what you're talking about with this, better mind your P's and Q's or we will replace you with an app, is something that threatens the nightmare of deflationary spiral. And that's really what scares the fresh fertilizer out of economic analysts. In that context, take a note here what Target has been doing. From the U.S. Uncut blog of September 23rd of 2015, an article by James Woods. Day after employees vote to unionize, Target announces fleet of robot workers. Just a day after pharmacy workers from a Brooklyn Target store phoned the union, the company announced plans to replace employees with robot workers in the near future. Last week, it was reported that the pharmacists had submitted their initial micro-union filing with the National Labor Relations Board after an initial ballot vote was passed 7-2. The filing was noteworthy as the workers become the first union at any Target store since the retail opened in 1902. Yet, less than a week later, in a seemingly unrelated press release, Casey Carl, C-A-R-L, the chief technology and strategy officer at Target, announced the company's plan to develop automation systems and replace workers with robots in their retail locations as part of a new program with Tech Stars, an industry leader with a reputation for accelerating startups. Combined with groups and politicians working towards a, talking about the unionization and skipping down, combined with groups and politicians working towards a $15 per hour minimum wage, has pushed Target to announce that within 2 years, it will have a concept store that open that will include robots instead of associates. Large corporations such as McDonald's and Walmart have been using the threat of automated workers for years to keep wages low and suppress union growth within their stores, but so far have been unsuccessful in automating the customer service portion of their operations.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing in, but by no means exclusively, economic and financial matters.
By the way, it won't just be low-wage workers at Target or McDonald's or Walmart or what have you that may get replaced. Paul Krugman of the New York Times has been among those few who have discussed the fact that many of the high-tech developments that are finding their way to market now will replace much better rewarded workers, much higher paid workers. I'm not going to talk about that here, but I am going to talk about a technology that is really potentially terrifying, and that is the smart contracts. Now, these will, among other things, replace lawyers. So those of you out there who are in law school and saying to yourselves, well, you know, I'm not working at McDonald's, I'm not at Target, I'm not at Walmart. Walmart, this doesn't apply to me. Not so fast. It's like that old joke about Tonto and the Lone Ranger. They're surrounded by Native Americans, and Lone Ranger says, well, Tonto, looks like we're done for. And Tonto says, what you mean we, white man? And so for you lawyers, it ain't just Target, McDonald's, or Walmart employees who are going to get apt out. Get apt out, and they're not going to opt out. They're going to get apt out. It's going to be you, too. From the MIT Technology Review of August 13th of 2015, an article by Tom Simoniter, Simoniti, S-I-M-O-N-I-T-E, Bitcoin's dark side could get darker. By the way, because the Bitcoin, it appears to have been developed by the underground Reich, in part in accordance with the dictates of the Austrian School of Economics. Talked about that in, for the record, 760, 764, 770, among other programs. And this is going to use some of that same technology basically to enable a number of interesting things. And again, note the sociopathic perspective being articulated by Gavin Wood, the chief technology officer of Ethereum that is developing this technology. Again, Bitcoin's dark side could get darker by Tom Simoniti or Simonite, MIT Technology Review of August 13th of 2015. Skipping down. A new Bitcoin-inspired technology that some investors believe will be much more useful and powerful may be set to unlock a new wave of criminal innovation. That technology is known as smart contracts, small computer programs that can do things like execute financial trades or notarize documents in a legal agreement. Intended to take the place of third-party human administrators such as lawyers, which are required in many deals and agreements, they can verify information and hold or use funds using similar cryptography to that which underpins Bitcoin. Some companies think smart contracts could make financial markets more efficient, or simplify complex transactions such as property deals. R-E-A-R-I, Jules, J-U-E-L-S, a cryptographer and professor at the Jacobs Pecknion Cornell Institute at Cornell Tech, believes they will also be useful for illegal activity, and with two collaborators, he has demonstrated how. Skipping down. They wrote them, speaking of the contracts, they wrote them to work on the recently launched smart contract platform Ethereum, E-T-H-E-R-E-U-M, as in Mary. One example is a contract offering a cryptocurrency reward for hacking a particular website. Ethereum's programming language makes it possible for the contract to control the promised funds. It will release them only to someone who provides proof of having carried out the job in the form of a cryptographically verifiable string added to the defaced site. Contracts with a similar design could be used to commission many kinds of crimes, say the researchers. Most provocatively, they outline a version designed to arrange the assassination of a public figure. A person wishing to claim the bounty would have to send information such as the time and place of the killing in advance. The contract would pay out after verifying that those details had appeared in several trusted news sources such as news wires. A similar approach could be used for lesser physical crimes such as high-profile vandalism. It was a bit of a surprise to me that these types of crimes in the physical world could be enabled by a digital system, says Jules. He and his co-authors say they are trying to publicize the potential for such activity to get technologists and policymakers thinking about how to make sure the positives of smart contracts outweigh the negatives, skipping down. However, Gavin Wood, chief technology officer at Ethereum, acknowledges it is likely that Ethereum will be used in ways that break the law, and even says that is part of what makes the technology interesting. Just as file sharing found widespread unauthorized use and forced changes in the entertainment and tech industries, illicit activity enabled by Ethereum could change the world, he says. The potential for Ethereum to alter aspects of society is of significant magnitude, says Wood. This is something that would provide a technical basis for all sorts of social changes, and I find that exciting, skipping down. You can implement any web service without there being a legal entity behind it, he says. The idea of making certain things impossible to legislate against is really interesting. Well, I'll see him on that one. Yeah, it is. However, what you are looking at here is a profoundly, almost universally subversive and implicitly, stridently, and potentially devastatingly anti-democratic perspective. And again, among the wonderful things that we've done here, putting out a contract on a public official, one wonders if you could perhaps fund a massive mass casualty terrorist incident in the same way. Just basically use the same thing and say to whoever, Al-Qaeda or ISIS or some Nazi group or whoever, or an individual, hey, do this, and there'll be this amount of money available for you in cryptocurrency. So for a hacker, bring down a nuclear power plant or two or five. Hey, you'll get rich. Millions will die, but you'll make out like a bandit. And notice again, the infatuation is almost the only way to put it that Gavin Wood has with this. He finds it exciting. He finds it fascinating. If I were to really express myself as I, if I were to give you my honest opinion of what I think of this stuff, I would lose my FCC license because I would have to reach into the foulest backwaters of my vocabulary in order to do it. Now, talking about the effects of technocratic fascism on major financial institutions that we know about, Goldman Sachs, Deutsche Bank, Credit Suisse, and the New York Mellon Bank are among the institutions that are now using the Symphony encrypted messaging service. And this is a challenge to regulators. We are told that regulators have the encryption keys for this communication service, end-to-end encryption. But in light of how regulators either were lax or were actually in bed with the very institutions that they were supposed to be regulating, I think we can view the article I'm about to excerpt with a very, very jaundiced eye indeed. From the RE Code blog of September 14th of 2015, an article by Arik Hesseldahl, A-R-I-K, last name H-E-S-S-E-L-D-A-H-L. Messaging service Symphony dodges regulatory action ahead of launch. And again, notes dodges regulatory action. Would we expect that from Goldman Sachs or Deutsche Bank or Credit Suisse dodging regulatory action? I'm shocked, shocked. And also very, very sarcastic under the circumstances. Skipping down. And this, again, is an end-to-end encrypted messaging system used by those and other institutions. So when the New York Department of Financial Services raised suspicions over the summer that banks might use Symphony's encryption technology to avoid the prying eyes of regulators, it seemed plausible that the company could face restrictions on how it does business. That didn't happen, or parenthetically, so we're told. Instead, on Monday, Symphony announced a deal with the DFS under which it agreed to store for 7 years copies of messages that its clients send on the service. Additionally, four banks, Goldman Sachs, Deutsche Bank, Credit Suisse, and the Bank of New York Mellon, which are both customers of and investors in Symphony, agreed to turn over copies of their encryption keys to an independent custodian. When a regulator wants to review encrypted messages, they will be able to decrypt them upon request. And one of the people, by the way, who was very skeptical of this is, not surprisingly, Senator Elizabeth Warren. And I am skeptical as well.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site also features many articles not included in programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
We're going to be taking a look at Facebook. And way back in the summer of 2010, July of 2010, I recorded For the Record 710 in your Facebook, warning that this wonderful, liberating technology that the people were so infatuated with could turn out to be anything but liberating. Facebook now has 1.5 billion users. The largest stockholder in Facebook is Peter Thiel, who is also the largest bankroller of Ron Paul's presidential campaign. He is the political idol of Edward Snowden, and Peter Thiel explicitly rejects democracy because he believes, on the one hand, it is inimical to wealth creation, and also, catch this, Peter Thiel, the largest stockholder in Facebook, doesn't think women should be allowed to vote. These are the kind of people that are wielding this kind of power. In the past, we have spoken about apps being developed by Facebook. One of them will enable Facebook to turn on your smartphone at will in order, allegedly, to determine what kind of music you or the people around you are listening to. They also have an app that we spoke about in because they can, part one, technocratic fascism. They have an app which will enable financial institutions to deny people credit because of the credit unworthiness of their friends and associates. Doesn't that sound? I should use my Eddie the Friendly Spook voice for stuff like this. Doesn't that sound like fun, boys and girls? You don't want to hang out with people who don't get good credit. They're a bunch of poo-poo heads. So stay away from them, and then Facebook won't see to it that you get your credit denied. Isn't that cool, boys and girls? Eddie likes things like that. I like things like that. And you like things like that, too, because we like to play with cool toys like smartphones with Facebook. Yay, and these regulators. What a bunch of poo-poo heads. Anyway, among the things that good old Facebook is doing, they have a state-of-the-art facial recognition system that apparently, surprise, surprise, is being utilized without what many see as proper regulation. We've talked about this before. From the International Business Times of September 3rd of 2015, an article by Christopher Zara, Z-A-R-A. Facebook keeps getting sued over face recognition software, and privacy groups say we should be paying more attention. Again, in your Facebook, I warned you back in July of 2010, in For the Record 710, look what is happening. In this article, again from IBT International Business Times, September 3rd of 2015, Christopher Zara writes, "Who owns your face? Believe it or not, the answer depends on which state you live in, and chances are you live in one that hasn't even weighed in on the subject yet. That could soon change. For the fourth time this year, Facebook Incorporated was hit with a class action lawsuit by an Illinois resident who says it's face recognition software violates an unusual state privacy law there. The latest complaint filed Monday underscores a quiet but high-stakes legal battle for the social networking giant, one that could reverberate throughout the rest of the U.S. tech industry and much of the private sector. With almost 1.5 billion active users, Facebook has amassed what probably is the world's largest private database of face prints, digital scans that contain the unique geometric patterns of its users' faces." Skipping down. "Currently, there are no comprehensive federal regulations governing the commercial use of biometrics, the category of information technology that includes face prints. And Bedoya said the government appears to be in no hurry to address the issue." He's one of the regulators, and skipping down still further. "Foundation, after months of negotiations, Bedoya said the groups grew frustrated by tech industry trade associations that would not agree to even the most minimal of protections, including a rule that would require companies to obtain written consent before collecting and storing face prints on consumers. Among the people that gave up is the Electronic Freedom Foundation and the ACLU." They just said, "Oh, well, sorry." And skipping down still further. "The latest suit comes from Frederick William Guller, G-U-L-L-E-N, an Illinois resident who doesn't even have a Facebook account, but who insists that Facebook created a template on his face when another user uploaded a photo of him." Skipping down still further. "A Facebook spokeswoman said the lawsuits are without merit and the company will defend itself vigorously against them. But the reality is, the cases could play out in a number of ways given that face recognition is largely untested legal territory." Well, again, look at the power with this app, the ability to turn on somebody's phone without their knowledge necessarily and monitoring not only them, but the people around them with the app that will permit financial institutions to deny someone credit because of the credit unworthiness of their friends or associates. This is tremendous power, and Facebook has 1.5 billion users, and so many of them are young people. And again, their chief stockholder, Peter Thiel, is explicitly opposed to democracy, in part because he doesn't think women should be allowed to vote. I wonder what Sheryl Sandberg, former Obama administration official and one of the top dogs in Facebook right now. I wonder what she thinks about that. Some of this stuff is, to me, almost surreal. I think, again, in For the Record 867, I'm going to do a fireside chat about technocratic fascism, because I think tying some of this together and showing how WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, and Edward Snowden link up with these people is worth doing. And someone we have spoken about in the past is Narendra Modi, the Indian premier. He came to the Silicon Valley to court the mavens of tech, so the titans of tech, or the sultans of tech, using an apropos term. He ostensibly wants to open up the Indian market to these companies. That is why they are one of the stated reasons they are so enthusiastic. Of course, India is the second most populous country on Earth. I suspect they may also be looking to set up manufacturing facilities to take it to complement the call centers and to take advantage of cheap labor, as we will see. The very Narendra Modi who is holding forth here and being oozed all over by Silicon Valley titans, including Ms. Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, is also a devotee of the RSS. That is a Hindu fascist / nationalist organization, one of whose alumni assassinated Mahatma Gandhi. Narendra Modi's candidacy was promoted in considerable measure by Pierre Omidyar, the top fellow at eBay, who also helped to bankroll the Maidan coup in Ukraine that saw the OUNB heirs come to power there. He, one of his proteges, a woman named Svetlana Zalishuk, is now helping to integrate Ukraine into NATO. And Pierre Omidyar is also working directly with the National Endowment for Democracy, which is a cutout for U.S. intelligence. Oh, yes, and he is also underwriting the latest journalistic ventures of Citizen Greenwald. That's Glenn Greenwald, Edward Snowden's leaking journalist of choice, and himself a longtime Nazi fellow traveler. Of Narendra Modi's trip to the Silicon Valley, we read now from the New York Times of September 27th of 2015. Narendra Modi, Indian premier, quotes Silicon Valley to try and ease nation's poverty. This by Vindu, V-I-N-D-U, Goel, G-O-E-L. And the article reads in part, Narendra Modi and Mark Zuckerberg have much in common, I suspect. Parenthetically, there may be a whole lot more to that than he realizes. But beginning again, Narendra Modi and Mark Zuckerberg have much in common. Mr. Modi, the Prime Minister of India, oversees a nation of 1.25 billion people. Mr. Zuckerberg, the chief executive of Facebook, runs a social network with 1.5 billion active users. Both see themselves as global leaders pushing for broad social change, and both routinely use social media to communicate with their many millions of fans. On Sunday, the two men engaged in a mutual admiration session at Facebook's Silicon Valley headquarters, with Mr. Modi fielding pre-selected questions from a crowd of Facebook employees and guests invited by the Indian embassy. Mr. Modi praised social networks like Facebook, Twitter, and even China's Weibo as useful tools for governing and diplomacy. Again, there may be far more to that than the writer means here. Again, there may be just a whole lot more to that Silicon Valley has been eager to assist. Now, the thrust of this is that, well, they want to open up the market there. I would note that Pierre Omidyar, again, was deeply involved with Modi's campaign, one of the people whom Pierre Omidyar has anointed to help with his outreach campaigns of various kinds in the third world, is a veteran of the Phoenix assassination program in Vietnam during the Vietnam War. We talked about that in past programs. Now, to give you an idea of the reality of the creature whom Mark Zuckerberg is oozing all over, and these other Silicon Valley people are oozing all over, an article from the Asia Times by M.K. Bhadrakumar, B-H-A-D-R-A-K-U-M-A-R. This from the Asia Times of September 10th of 2015. Modi blows his cover, and the loss is India's. Skipping down. Now, the RSS, again, is a Hindu nationalist and fascist organization, one of whose alumni assassinated Mahatma Gandhi. Skipping down. Modi himself used to be an activist of the RSS, but an elaborate charade was kept so far that Modi was in command of the government. The Indian media has since reported that the RSS eventually gave thumbs up to the government after Modi and his cabinet colleagues trooped in to meet the RSS bosses and testified at the hearing on their schemes and achievements, unquote, in the government. No Indian government has ever been made to look so foolish and diffident. Why the RSS decided to subject Modi and his cabinet to such a dressing down is anyone's guess. Skipping down. The upshot of the RSS hearing is that Modi has blown his cover, which helped him so far as prime minister to create an impression that he is a humanist and a devout follower of Buddhism who viewed with distaste the excesses committed by the Hindu zealots in the minority communities in India, such as the attacks on Christian churches. Under the Modi government, incidents of communal tension involving Hindus and Muslims have sharply increased, according to official statistics. However, observers have generously absolved the Prime Minister of any responsibility in this regard and are willing to suspend disbelief. That cover has now been blown. And basically, the RSS surprise is looming Modi. Again, all of this wonderful, upbeat stuff about how well he wants to use high-tech to lift his country out of poverty. In For the Record 851, we took a look at how Modi is weakening, moving to weaken his country's child labor laws. And if he can do so, that will drive down the Indian wage scale still further, because they'll be competing. Workers there will be competing against children who will be virtual slaves, and that will make the labor used by anybody who is setting up a company in India that much cheaper. And we'll conclude just with this thought. Apple's headquarters, I don't know if they still do it, but for a long time they had a large billboard viewable from the freeway which said, "Think Different." And they had various people. They had Cesar Chavez and John Lennon and Albert Einstein. One of the people that they had was Mahatma Gandhi. And again, Gandhi was murdered by a member of, an alumnus of the RSS, which sort of places this whole thing in a different kind of belief. Think Different indeed. Nowadays, who knows, maybe using a smart contract and Bitcoin, they could have assassinated Gandhi online and in complete anonymity. This concludes For the Record program number 866. Because They Can, part two, more on technocratic fascism. This is being recorded on October 4th of the year 2015. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.